So am I still waiting, waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review,
no, you go on. I was just going to mention about the naming of WrestleMania. I don't know if you noticed in the on the DVD, they talked about the how Howard Finkel came up with the name WrestleMania.
Yeah, just go explain it. Did you just do it, or you didn't have your on-air voice, which I can tell the difference from.
From Madison Square Garden, the World Wrestling Federation presents WrestleMania. The Executioner to meet Tito Santana. Special Delivery Jones versus King Kong Bundy. Ricky Steamboat versus Matt Bourne. Brutus Beefcake to tangle with David Sammartino. Greg Valentine to meet the challenger, Junkyard Dog. The tag team title matchup. The champions, Wyndham and Rotundo, to meet the challengers, Nikolai Volkov and the Iron Sheik. The $15,000 slam match, Andre the Giant to meet Big John Studd. The World Wrestling Federation Ladies Championship matchup, Leilani Kai, the champion, to meet the challenger, Wendy Richter. And in the main event, Mr. Wonderful, Paul Orndorff, and Roddy Piper face World Wrestling Federation champion Hulk Hogan and Mr. T. Special guest referee Muhammad Ali. Special ring announcer Billy Martin. Special timekeeper Liberace.
Welcome to Review Away, everybody. My name is John Pollock, and I am joined by Wei Ting. How are you doing today, Wei?
Doing okay. Doing not bad.
Big show ahead of us today. We're going to be joined later on in the show by WWE Hall of Famer Jimmy Hart, who's going to be stopping by to chat about WrestleMania 1 as he was involved in two of the matches on this card.
Yeah, I mean, and what a perfect person to do this review with, because obviously Jimmy Hart knows a lot about celebrity endorsement in professional wrestling, and this was really, WrestleMania 1 was really the first show that used that on a hyper level.
WrestleMania 1 way, this was your choice last week.
Well, this was...
Or was it?
Your choice.
Oh, it was my choice.
After you were...
Sorry, we had a collaborative effort last week where we decided to review WrestleMania 1. This was a show you had never seen before, so I'm just curious, going into this show, you must have had... Like, obviously, you have heard all of the legend coming out of this show, but, I mean, your expectations, especially after we watched the big productions over the last couple of weeks, WrestleMania 19, even 14, and then we go to WrestleMania 1 in Madison Square Garden.
Well, really, this is perhaps the oldest pay-per-view, the oldest show that we have ever reviewed on this program.
Yes, it would be.
And, you know, me, of course, I've never... My knowledge of the era before, even like the 80s and definitely before the 80s, I know practically nothing about it. And so for me, going into this show, I was expecting a really dull, boring time.
Well, you went into this with huge hopes, clearly. Myself, I'm fascinated by this time period where the WWE... or WWF at the time, was expanding nationally at this time, but still had their roots as this regional Northeast promotion, and you were seeing the growth while they were still this promotion that was not too long ago living and dying by monthly events at Madison Square Garden and building to a big show every month there in New York and traveling around the Northeast to your Bostons, Philadelphias, Baltimores. And here they were branching out. This show, if I'm not mistaken, there actually were some pay-per-view outlets that did carry it, but it was so minuscule at the time.
Was there even a pay-per-view industry at that time?
It really wasn't at all relevant at the time. And if this was on any pay-per-view outlets, like, the number was so tiny. This show was completely based upon the closed-circuit business it was going to do around the country, going to whether it be hockey arenas or theaters. Movie theaters to watch it, concert halls. Yes. That's what they were banking on. It was similar to the way they promoted the big 1976 show at Shea Stadium, where they had Ali and Inoki and all these other promotions kind of got in on it to present their own matches. So this was a huge, huge endeavor by the company. And as much as you look back at WWE history, this was a huge show for the company. They gambled a whole lot of money on it.
Yeah.
And it would, in turn out to be this gigantic franchise for the company.
I thought this would be a good show to review this week because this past week the WWE released a DVD about the true story of WrestleMania.
The WWE's true story of WrestleMania.
Yes.
But nonetheless, I've gotten to see about the first third of it. You've watched the whole thing.
I have watched the entire thing, and I know some of you have out there as well. And my viewing of it, I actually really enjoyed the DVD. It doesn't take you into too much detail, because how much could it in the span of... How can you condense 26 years into 2 hours, right?
The footage that they have is just phenomenal.
Some of it is actually fantastic. Just the idea that even... I think the earliest documentary footage we saw was at WrestleMania 9 with Vince backstage. He had actually hired a camera crew to document, and you get to see things like Vince talking to a very young Shawn Michaels, telling him, if the crowd doesn't sound loud, it's because it's an outdoor arena, don't worry about that. And like Shawn, just being assured, like, this is Shawn Michaels, Mr. Yeah. WrestleMania, being assured that when he goes out there, to watch out for something like this. Definitely a very interesting documentary. And it starts off talking about the territorial system and the WWE's rise to a national company, which led into WrestleMania.
It did. And there was this great clip they had of Vince McMahon producing a promo with Hulk Hogan and Gene Okerlund pushing WrestleMania, and Vince kind of telling them to get the message across that this is not available on TV. It's on closed circuit only. Mm-hmm. Because as much as people look back fondly on WrestleMania, in the week leading up to it, I mean, this show was... The advances were really, really bad across the country. I mean, people were expecting this to be a giant flop based on the final 7 to 10 days. And it was in that last week that it really picked up. They got Hogan and Mr. T on Saturday Night Live the night before. Liberace was, I believe, also on that same show, who was pushing the event. They got on the Richard Belzer show, which a lot of people will remember. That's where Hogan actually applied like a guillotine. And I've actually seen the clip where Belzer just lands right on the ground. It was a huge incident at the time.
He lands on the ground and cuts his head open. And then he just comes to in seconds. And his instinctive TV mind knew to throw the break. And as he turns his head to the camera, you can see blood flowing down the back of his head.
Yeah.
And all this is on YouTube, of course. Belzer would go on to sue Hogan in WWE.
Yeah, so it was in that last week that Mr. T at the time, today you look at him as this guy who
like
shows up in cameo roles in B movies or D-level movies. But at that time, the A-Team was a really big show, and he was viewed as this legit tough guy. I mean, it would be the equivalent of getting a UFC star, a top-level star, I would feel.
Or like a Vin Diesel or like an action star. Of some
but
sort,
someone that
perhaps.
People believed legit was a super... tough guy.
Uh-huh.
And whether you believed or not about pro wrestling, you really believed in this guy Mr. T, who was serious.
Mm-hmm.
So the time had a huge dealing with it, with the success of this show and the amount of publicity that Hogan Mr.
Yes.
T got in that last week.
Yes. And of course, talking about Mr. T, the concept of WrestleMania that separated it from supercards that existed before it, such as Starrcade, was Vince's idea to just load this thing with celebrity involvement. And it really, you saw it with Mr. T. Who else was there? Well, we'll get into who else there was. But prior to this, there was also the Rock and Wrestling Connection that he went co-promoted with MTV. They did a number of shows using Cyndi Lauper on MTV before WrestleMania.
You can really make the argument that MTV and the WWF really were interdependent with one another in the creation of both as these national brands. MTV had just launched, and they were looking for something to really catapult it, because the war to settle the score, it had taken place just in February of that year. It did a huge rating on MTV, and it led perfectly into WrestleMania 6 weeks later, and you had both of these companies trying to rise up on a national platform, and both were helping each other.
And the concept of using celebrities to promote pro wrestling is still a tactic used today. I mean, it's something that as purists, we often hear a lot of criticism about, and it can be done tastefully or distastefully, but in this instance, it was just interesting to see the very first usage of this on a big scale. I don't know if you noticed this, John, I just thought about this, but on the DVD, they also talk about how WrestleMania got its name. Did you notice?
And that the story is that it was Howard Finkel that came up with the idea, and
he basing it off of Beatlemania.
Yes. I had also heard at one time that they had actually thrown around the name of calling it Hulkamania.
Did you?
Can you imagine if they had gone with that?
Hulkamania.
I have a hard time believing that.
And then what, they just changed the name if Hulk Hogan wasn't around?
Well, that was the thing. It's like,
I don't have a hard time believing.
It's not like they were looking at 1985 and thinking, what are we going to call this event that's going to go on forever after this? There was no guarantee there would be a second event of it. It was just one big event, and it was designed to promote Hulk Hogan. This was a vehicle to make Hulk Hogan a national celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get into the event way, because this is going to be a very different review from typical shows, because this was... Whoever directed this or produced it, it was such an easy formula. It was match, throw, interview, interview, match.
Well, listen, at this point, was there ever, was the concept of even a pro wrestling pay-per-view even created at this time? This was about as straightforward and as basic of a wrestling show as you could have.
Yeah, it was, I really feel that Vince took a lot from probably seeing Starcade in 83 when it launched, and it turned out it was presented exactly like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it lacked the celebrities. It was based in a completely different part of the country.
No vignettes, no video packages.
No Photoshop.
Nothing.
This was, and
no,
we should.
No blow up dolls, no ketchup.
Amazing. And we should note, I mean, a big strength of this show, Way, was the fact that it was taking place in New York, and media wise, had a giant leg up on their competition, where the NWA was promoting in Greensboro, North Carolina, and here the WWE had, they had MTV at their disposal. They were on Saturday Night Live the night before. Mm-hmm. I mean, New York was the city where you were going to get the most publicity for your event, and it shone a huge national spotlight on this event, so it did have that in its back pocket.
And it made it seem hip, more hip.
Absolutely. So we open up the show, Way, and I watched, I was so pissed when I went to watch this, okay? Here's my situation, everybody. I have a storage area underground where I have thrown all my wrestling tapes and stuff. So it's a real pain in the ass to go get these tapes on a weekly basis. I have, like a nerd, put them into chronological order.
You have, wow.
I have. So, and I have... when I was like 12 or 13 years old, myself and my brother bought the WrestleMania VHS box set, where it had WrestleManias 1 through 13 in a box set. So I went downstairs and I found it, pulled out WrestleMania 1, went all the way upstairs, and I live in a condo, everybody. So when I say I went upstairs, it's like 25 floors. Then I have it there all week, and then I finally, last night, went to go watch this, throw in the tape, and it's starting, and it's... I'm rewinding it the whole way. And it's like, this event was not 3.5 hours. And I hit play. I had put WrestleMania 4 into the WrestleMania 1 box.
Oh.
Fuck. And me, being as lazy as I am, found it online rather than going all the way back downstairs.
So,
but man, is that annoying.
That is annoying. You're almost better off just tossing those tapes away.
I guess. I always thought, having these tapes be great, and now it's like everything's online that
everything
I want to find.
Online.
It's not something I recommend, but I feel that I am, by you and I reviewing these, it's not like you and I would be going out and buying these shows or renting these shows if we weren't doing this review, and we're providing a service to the community. So if I, on the off chance on a week, have to find a stream online of an old show, chances are I own this show in some form or fashion.
Yes.
The amount of pay-per-views you and I have, the amount of money we have put into pay-per-views in our lifetime.
Yeah.
I think we get a pass when we have to go get a stream of something.
Yeah, I mean, live and, I doubt that they're making...
Every WWE and TNA show that happens, we pay for it for the law.
Exactly. And I doubt that they make that much money from... a single purchase of a WrestleMania 1 or Road Wild 98. Where would you even find that? Where would you even find most of these shows that we review?
Great point. So anyway, folks, I found WrestleMania 1. My whole point here is that the stream I was watching of this, it was definitely a... it had the WWE Attitude logo. Not the Attitude logo, but their current logo.
Yeah.
So definitely it was released. This was like a re-release years and years later. And I know for a fact, like in the main event, that Mr. T and Hogan came out to Eye of the Tiger. And in here it was dubbed over with Real American.
Oh.
So I'm sure for some of the music and stuff, I got the copyright-free version.
Oh. Okay.
So anyway, it opens up with a... This contrasts greatly with the other WrestleMania openings we've had for this show over the last couple of weeks. A still photography package that confirmed this was, in fact, 1985. They scroll through the matches with each still photo
this
of
was a
the combatants.
This was a slideshow set to really bad guitar music.
But then they got really creative. For the celebrities, they would put, like, Muhammad Ali on both sides of the screen, and they'd flip him for the right side of the screen and have the opposite image on the left side. And they did this for all the celebrities.
Okay.
But they just took the photo and flipped it.
Great.
Hell of a technology in 1985. And then Gorilla Monsoon welcomes us along with Jesse Ventura. And Ventura has always stated that he was so nervous during this opening that Gorilla had to have his arm holding up Ventura during this opening.
Was that right?
Yeah.
You couldn't tell.
No, you couldn't. Then they throw to Howard Finkel, who introduces Gene Okerlund to sing the national anthem.
Gene Okerlund? Like,
not quite Ashanti.
Howard Finkel introduces this person to sing the national anthem, and then he pauses it. I'm expecting some, you know, some big-time singer. Like, look at all the celebrities on the show. They should have maybe gotten...
Little Richard.
Anybody. Any musician. Instead, Mean Gene Okerlund. To sing the national anthem.
The man with such commercial hits as Tutti Frutti was going to sing the national anthem and did so with a cheat sheet. He had the lyrics written down.
He had to read lyrics.
And read it off a piece of paper.
This was great. This is so funny.
This was just like a gritty produced WWE presentation. Well, it was like the WWE at times, it's like it's so slick in production.
Hold on a second, but this is 1985 when TV was not even that advanced in general. I would say for 1985 that this was probably a pretty slick production.
I'm saying that's what obviously we're watching this with 2011 eyes. I'm just saying, yeah, for 1985, just to contrast it to today's production, it's night and day. And I think it's fun to watch this where
yeah.
Everything is, it is much looser and it's much less controlled as it is today.
Yes, yes.
So he sang, he asked fans to sing along for the finish. They did. Then we go to Lord Alfred Hayes, who his sole job on this show was to kill time between matches so that the talent could get backstage and then the next guys could be ready for their interviews. And for this first throw, he sends it off to Gene Okerlund for a pre-recorded interview with Tito Santana. And this is right as the executioner walks behind Lord Alfred Hayes to the ring.
Yeah, these were very weird segments. Lord Alfred Hayes...
He was positioned terribly.
Well, and he also looked very distracted or nervous.
Well, he had
something.
Guys walking around and... We even had instances where they walked in front of the camera and cut off Hayes as he was looking into the camera.
I don't know if that was part of the intended effect.
I doubt that.
To show that. But, yeah, it was just, you know, the entire production itself still seemed very slick, even for 1985. Everybody, all the announcers were very much on their game. It was just one thing after the other. But Lord Alfred Hayes here, for some reason, he just seemed kind of off.
Tito Santana says that no one will stop him, and he's going to introduce the executioner to the big leagues. So then Santana walks off, Okerlund stays there, and then he welcomes in the executioner, Buddy Rose.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he's going after the leg. He's going after the leg that Greg Valentine hurt, and says he is a big leaguer.
Okay.
Simple promo to open up. So we've got the executioner versus Tito Santana in the trivia answer match. And we get a crisscross spot early on into a backdrop by Tito Santana and then a drop kick to the floor. Santana applies a side headlock. This was the high spot of the match. These were some of the most basic matches you will ever see, folks.
And you know what?
This was the Northeast WWWF style.
Hold on a second, but you know what? Even though this was so simple, I think this is better than most of what I see today. It was simple, and I could understand it.
This match was designed to go out and simply warm up the crowd, and you would forget about this match when it was over.
Yeah, but still, I thought the work was pretty solid.
I mean, it's so hard. It's like there's. No I wasn't a fan in 1985, so it's like I don't really have the perspective.
But
to
I'm
say
even,
what was a strong 1985 match.
But I'm saying if Daniel Bryan and Sheamus came out and wrestled this match on Raw, I would think it would be a perfectly fine match. Both of these guys, everybody on this card for the most part, was just very seasoned, and they knew. They just looked very smooth and capable in the ring.
This match was better than half the stuff on Victory Road.
Well, exactly what I mean. No convoluted finish. Very straightforward. Basic.
The Executioner delivers a kick to the gut of Santana. He goes to the figure four, but stopped by Santana. Santana fires up for his comeback, goes for a pile driver, but it's countered into a back body drop. Executioner goes to the top. He's thrown off a la Ric Flair. Santana goes for a splash, but Executioner gets his knees up. Then Santana sends Executioner to the floor. He delivers a suplex into the ring and then hits the flying forearm and applies the figure four for the win. And they replay the finish, and they tease that this is going to eventually lead to a rematch between Greg Valentine and Tito Santana, with whom Valentine defeated for the Intercontinental Championship. Very, very simple match. Executioner said he was going to go for the leg. Santana avoided it, and he won with the figure four, and it's going to build up to a match with Valentine.
I thought it was good.
This was the first match in WrestleMania history.
Mm-hmm.
We then go to Lord Alfred Hayes backstage, and he throws to a pre-tape with Gene Okerlund. Okerlund is with Special Delivery Jones. This would be the equivalent of Santino Marella for modern fans. Jones says this is the moment he has been waiting for, and moment would be the operative word for this next match. He says, today is the day for me, and we're going to get down today. They then bring in Jimmy Hart and King Kong Bundy. They come in. He wants Jones to think about the Avalanche and the five count. Simple promo.
Yeah. Again, I mean, you know, we say simple, but what they were quick and they were concise.
You have like 30 seconds here.
And
Okerlund was quick to just cut off and throw if he
had
to.
And I found them all good, especially by today's standards. It was like everybody knew their characters so well, probably because they came up with them themselves. And they were just told, you have 30 seconds, say that you're going to beat this guy. And they did it. They did it with their energy. They did it with the tone of their character. And it was just in and out, done.
And you didn't get anything that was, whether it be a match or a promo, nothing went long on this show. And I'm sure that in the back of their mind, they were like, we don't want to take any chance of us going overtime here and the main event gets fucked or something like that. Because this really was that main event was 95% of the people buying this show was for that main event. There was really, you know, there were some other attractions on this show, but that was the draw.
Uh-huh.
So I would think for the first time they were doing something of this magnitude that I'm sure time was a huge factor for them.
Sure. I mean, I know nothing about how they did their TV beforehand, but this was a big experiment for the company.
So then we get King Kong Bundy and Special Delivery Jones. Jones gets a decent reaction here from the New York audience. The bell rings. Jones runs into a bear hug. He's rammed into the turnbuckle and then takes the Avalanche, a slam, and King Kong Bundy gets the win in 25 seconds. But the announcers call it a win in record time, and Howard Finkel lists the match at 9 seconds.
Did you actually time it at 25?
I watched on my thing. I rewound to see what the start point was and then when the pin was. Monsoon says the former record was 23 seconds, and we have a new record. Now, I understand this is 1985, folks. The first stopwatch was patented in 1822. So, who are you fooling here?
I don't know. What do you mean?
I'm saying, like, why are they trying to they were trying to push this was 9 seconds. I was like, anyone can watch this and realize that was not 9 seconds.
Okay, but who would rewind? There were no VCRs at this time. Who would even rewind to do this? Who would actually? It's like gimmicking a dude's weight. Who would actually care?
All right. So,
except some wrestling fan from 27 years later.
What is the quickest match in WWE history that you can think of? There was that Rock Big Boss Man match that we reviewed at a Survivor Series in 98. It was like 4 seconds.
That was 4 seconds?
I would assume that would have to be the shortest. You can't have a match in less than 3 seconds.
Yeah.
So maybe that's the
unless it was unless it was a specialty type of match, like a knockout match or something.
They tried to maybe they tried to sell it as a match. -2 seconds. Okerlund is backstage with Matt Bourne, who would later go on to become Doink the Clown. Bourne's gimmick is he wears sunglasses. He calls Steamboat one of the best conditioned wrestlers in the world, but his downfall is he is too nice of a guy. Steamboat comes in looking ripped, says it's a huge test for everyone on the card, and calls it the biggest event ever. He says he came to this territory to develop a meanness.
Mm.
That's why he came here.
Okay.
Steamboat, one of the few guys, not the only though, who was on the very first WrestleMania and the very first Starrcade, along with Roddy Piper and Greg Valentine.
Oh, interesting.
So
maybe that's a review we should do.
Starrcade 83?
The first one.
Yeah. It's a very, very strong show. So we get Matt Bourne and Ricky Steamboat. A funny story here, Way, is that it was Jericho who was, I can't remember if it was our interview or another interview during his latest book run, was talking about the WrestleMania 25 a few years ago, where they wanted, it was going to be Jericho against Greg Valentine, Jimmy Snuka, and Roddy Piper, mm-hmm. with the theme that it's the 25th anniversary, even though it was technically the 24th. And Vince wanted everyone on the opponent side to be from WrestleMania 1, and that they wanted Valentine in there, and Jericho, obviously seeing the limitations of a match with Piper, Snuka, and Valentine, pushed for Ricky Steamboat, mm-hmm. because Vince didn't realize Steamboat had also been on the WrestleMania 1 card.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Wow.
Look how many shows this guy's produced.
Ah, that's true.
First ever WrestleMania.
Well,
come on.
Second, but your own show, I mean, I guess you would figure that. But, you know, we have heard from people like Dave Lagana, you know, who have gone on to tell stories about how they would have to remind Vince of his own storylines.
Have we ever have we told the Funaki story?
No.
Where this was a story we heard from Jimmy Corderas, where Funaki, he had been released by the company, and he showed up. Was it Funaki? No, it wasn't Funaki. Oh, Christ. I'm editing this because I'll be called racist. It was Jimmy Yang.
Oh, you racist. Don't edit it.
Have we ever told the story about Jimmy Yang?
No, we haven't.
Because this was a story I heard from Jimmy Corderas, where Jimmy Yang was backstage at a show in Cincinnati where he lives, and Shawn Michaels wanted to test out some new move of some sort, and Jimmy Yang was there, and Michaels asked Yang, hey, can you come in the ring and I can work this move out with you? And Yang was like, I'd love to. I brought my gear, but I'm not under contract, and technically I can't be in the ring, because he had just been fired a couple of months back. So apparently Shawn Michaels said this and to Vince, and Vince was like, well, why can't you go into the ring to Jimmy, not realizing that he had been fired months ago, and Yang informed him, well, I was released here months ago. And Vince was like, oh, get this guy a contract. And they signed him there on the spot.
Wow.
So a lot of stuff that, you know,
anyone who gets released, just show up one day and maybe
always bring your gear. And always be ready to go.
And just talk to Vince. Say hi. Hey, why aren't
just
you
going
around
in the locker room? Say, hey, anyone trying some new moves out? I would love to take it.
And get a job. That's it.
Great.
Wow.
Miz wants to try out his new chair shot to the back spot. 15 of them.
Yes.
Offer. All right. Anyway.
Oh, boy.
How did we get onto? Somehow we went from Matt Bourne and Ricky Steamboat to the Miz.
Yeah.
Steamboat goes for a side headlock early on. Bourne finally gets out, delivers a reverse atomic drop, and then a knee lift to Steamboat. Steamboat comes back with a chop off the second rope and then back to the headlock. Looked like he was going for a guillotine here, Way. Steamboat hits a series of chops and then a back suplex. Steamboat then hits a shoulder block and then hits a crossbody off the top rope for the win. And Monsoon calls the finish. This youngster Steamboat literally flew through the air.
Mm-hmm. You can immediately see that Steamboat is the most athletic performer on this show by far.
Yes.
I thought he moved way better than everybody on this show. And it's just interesting to see the crowd react to such simple things like leapfrogs. A leapfrog and they wouldn't, ooh, it'd be like nothing they've ever seen.
Well, you had
seen.
Such a basic style at this time period in that territory that really a cross body, that was a big deal.
Yep.
Like imagine a wrestler doing a
shooting star press.
Well, I was just going to say, imagine if a wrestler did a splash off a steel cage on Raw Monday night. Be nothing. You'd forget about it by Tuesday. And here, Jimmy Snuka, how famous is that
splash?
That famous splash off the cage.
Yeah.
It was something they had never seen before. It was amazing. And now you've done so much that it takes.
Well, like,
what
sport,
does it take now for,
yeah.
for something to be really a memorable spot?
The sport has to evolve, but I of course, the problem is when you know, wrestlers abuse these high spots and they stop meaning anything anymore.
Lord Alfred Hayes has apparently bought a WrestleMania program here because our next throw from him, he has got the program under his elbow.
Okay.
He
looks so off here. It looked like he needed to like pee or something this whole time.
Well, he probably had to stand there for 3 hours. He's like, don't move. These matches were so short, he didn't have time.
It was so weird.
So my,
and then Matt Bourne almost walks in front of the camera on his way back.
Yes, he stops and then goes around the other way. I have just Hayes written down here on my notes, so I keep going to say Michael Hayes.
Yeah.
It's Lord Alfred Hayes. So anyway, next up, Okerlund is with David Sammartino and his father, Bruno. David says he's been training hard, and what goes around comes around. Bruno then does a promo saying that Luscious Johnny will walk into his fist if he gets into this. Bruno Sammartino can do no wrong.
Huh.
This was yep. Bruno Sammartino, the reaction this guy got was tremendous.
Yeah.
They then brought in Beefcake and Luscious Johnny Valiant. Johnny speaks like a million miles a minute. When I was a little kid and I'd rent old tapes, I always loved the Luscious Johnny V. But I've got to say, very much your stereotypical wrestling heel here at the time. Beefcake just says nothing and then makes this like spit sound out of his mouth. So at least he was always a shitty promo. Brutus Beefcake and David Sammartino. Beefcake is introduced from Parts Unknown.
Yeah.
David is the first one to get a reaction. Bruno got a massive pop when he was introduced.
Huge.
If you were not going to Madison Square Garden shows in the 60s and 70s, you cannot appreciate just how big Bruno Sammartino was.
I have never seen Bruno Sammartino wrestle.
This guy, one of the highlights of ever working for the law was, it was a couple of years ago when we were trying to set something up to do an interview with Bruno. And I ended up calling him to line something up, and I ended up talking to him for like an hour and a half. Like, he was just telling me these stories, and it was just amazing to hear this guy. His memory is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
just like one of the most genuine people in pro wrestling. Like, a lot of times from that era, you get guys who are just there so, you know, remember things with such exaggerated details. I mean, Sammartino is like, remembers things to like the second. If he didn't draw a house, he would like admit it. Just a phenomenal guy if you ever get to hear this guy chat.
But the reaction he got coming out right here, even as a manager, he really, like, just from the reaction, you could tell this dude was the main star of the company from a different era.
He got, like, one of the three biggest reactions on the show.
Yeah.
Maybe, for his involvement later in the match, maybe the biggest reaction. It was huge.
Yeah.
Ventura... as the match starts, Ventura brings up that losing at WrestleMania will set your career back 6 to 12 months, maybe even 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's how important this event is, right?
Well, it's funny because if this was a UFC bout, that statement would be completely true.
Then a Greco-Roman wrestling bout broke out between these two. We saw a front face lock by David. Ventura notes the audience is getting a good view of the Beefcake, and Gorilla just laughed. The biggest spot early on is a body slam by Beefcake, but David holds on for the armbar and works on the left arm and shoulder. Ventura notes that some like to watch a slower pace.
This was a very slow pace. This was an extremely
slow pace, and I'm sorry, but I had no interest in these two. I thought they were just...
Well, it was slow, but it was just a different style. I mean, especially coming after Steamboat, you know, who's just flying around everywhere. This was just a lot of grappling.
I thought these two were just... I thought this was like the worst match on the show. There was a hip toss by Beefcake.
No, I wouldn't say so.
San Martino gets a leg trip and a double toe hold. This was when Monsoon applauds the work of camera number five. He specifically calls out camera number five for their great work.
Yeah, so that's good.
Awesome.
What's wrong with that?
You don't usually hear shout outs to cameras.
The cameramen should get more shout outs.
Do you say that as someone disgruntled?
Yeah. I don't think camera people get enough acknowledgement.
I did a throw today for the Fight Network where I was throwing to Battlefield Fight League 5.
Uh-huh.
And I gave props to Eddie the Editor for his tremendous promo building up this event.
Good for you. Thank you.
I felt bad because I didn't know how to pronounce his last name. And neither did my cameraman. So okay. It was Eddie the Editor.
But I didn't think anything of that. Oh, I thought it was actually a nice touch.
Did you smile when you heard it?
Yes.
You just kind of look down your notes and smile?
Yeah, go.
Thanks, Gorilla.
Go, fifth cameraman.
Beefcake is on his back with David working on the back, and Monsoon cites David's amateur ability. Beefcake gets out with an eye rake and then goes on the offense. The crowd was more into this when San Martino hit a back body drop and then a follow-up uppercut. Then we saw punches from San Martino, a vertical suplex, and then a two-count for San Martino. Then David is tossed to the floor. Johnny body slams him, and this is when Bruno gets involved. He throws Johnny V into the ring, and this is when the crowd is just going nuts. Bruno and David get in. First, it's two-on-one with the heels attacking Bruno. David makes the save, and this leads to a double disqualification. Great use of Bruno. This whole match was designed for his big involvement physically for this match, and they went crazy for Bruno. I wasn't a big fan of the match. It was like 12 minutes, and I didn't find either guy to be good workers. And
what? Really? No. I actually enjoyed both of them, including Beefcake. I thought the chain wrestling was really good. I mean, I just like different styles and watching people do different styles, and I thought they did a good chain wrestling style match here. They built up to like a vertical suplex that got a huge pop.
I like the idea of where they started off so slow that by the time they worked up to like even an uppercut, the crowd was more into it. But I just got the sense the whole crowd, the second Bruno came out, all they wanted to see was Bruno get involved here.
Sure.
And David San Martino was simply, we have to watch this guy as a means to an end to get our Bruno pop.
Maybe because he wasn't over, but I mean, as a technical match, I thought it was perfectly fine.
All right. Then we get another throw, this time to Gene Okerlund with Greg Valentine and Jimmy Hart. Valentine says that he hits them and nails them hard, and hence his nickname, The Hammer. And he's lean, mean, and full of fighting fury. This comes from the heel textbook of promos. Then we get JYD coming in, says he needs a bone to chew. I guess he's going to get that at WrestleMania. Greg Valentine and the Junkyard Dog for the Intercontinental Championship. JYD comes out to theme music, and it sounds like Finkel redid his intro and post here on at least my viewing of this.
So maybe they changed the music.
Yes. I couldn't even tell if this was... Because he would always come out to Another One Bites the Dust, right?
Oh, okay.
So anyway.
That makes sense.
JYD hits headbutts off of his knees early that Valentine sells in the...
Do you think that's part of the reason why they keep Howard Finkel around? It's just so he can redub his shows from years past?
I'm sure that's one of the benefits of having him. You don't have to ask me a list of reasons why you would want Howard Finkel, but for whatever reason, this guy is on WWE.com.
Yeah.
When we've got other announcers.
Huh.
Anyway.
I just imagine maybe like 10 years down the line, if they decide to sell a DVD from 2000 that they don't have the rights to, would they bring back Lillian Garcia just to revoice some of those introductions?
Maybe. Maybe she'll get called back.
That's weird.
Then we get Valentine attacking the right leg and stretching the ligaments, as Monsoon says. JYD blocks the figure four leg lock. Valentine then takes two headbutts and does the flare flop in the middle of the ring. Ventura notes that JYD smells victory just like he smells dog food.
Well, he's a dog.
He's literally portrayed as a dog here, everyone, with this hard head.
Human dog. Dogs have hard heads?
Yep.
They do?
Just like Samoans, according to the WWF and their history. JYD grabs Jimmy Hart. Valentine runs in as JYD sidesteps, and Valentine takes out Jimmy Hart. Fans go nuts for this. They fight into the corner. JYD is punching Valentine, and then Valentine with a beautiful double leg takedown and gets his feet on the ropes and gets the win. Tito Santana then runs into the ring and protests, saying that Valentine got his feet on the ropes, and the referee starts the match and just counts out Valentine. As Ventura's outraged here, Valentine, he had a whole 10 count to react to this, but just stood there on the floor in shock.
Well, he knew
and made the wise choice. Just get counted out. You keep your title.
Yeah.
Smart heel.
Well, he obviously wanted to win. He knew he couldn't beat the dog.
Could not beat the dog. This is when they showed the replay of the bump that Jimmy Hart took off the apron. Holy shit. He like went back first onto the cement floor off the ring.
Yeah, wow.
Incredible bump for this guy. I can't believe he moves around so naturally now.
Mm-hmm. I like that they had Santana come back in to change the decision. Why don't they do this anymore? To get guys to come back in and reverse the decision.
There's no loyalty anymore. There's no brotherhood. Guys don't worry about other people's finishes.
Okay.
For Santana, I mean, he wants to get the Intercontinental title back, and he also wants to gain revenge on Greg Valentine. So why would you come out and try to help your friend get the title? Well, then it's like two camps having the fight. That's like John Jones coming in.
He cares about his friends more than winning the title, I suppose. Anyway, not a great technical matchup, but
no,
the crowd loves
They were in
JYD.
A junkyard dog. Lord Alfred Hayes, then he's doing his next throw, and usually we'd get maybe one guy walking past him. This time, we got Freddie Blassie, Iron Sheik, and Nikolai Volkoff, and two flags walking past Hayes as he's doing his throw, right in front of the camera.
Mm-hmm. I do think that was intentional, John. It's just to show that these guys are on their way into the ring.
Hayes also referred to the baby faces in the next tag match as athletes. Okerlund is with Sheik, Volkoff, and Blassie in a pre-recorded segment.
All right, fans, one of the big feature matches this afternoon, Wyndham Rotunda, to defend against these two men, Nikolai Volkoff and Iron Sheik, with Fred Blassie in their corner.
You know, Gene Lean, this is my best time of life for chef situation. Same thing, my partner, Nikolai Volkoff. Ask my manager, Mr. Blassie, gonna tell you.
What about
I predict I got the next World Tag Team Champions right here.
Okay, comrade Volkoff, I'm sorry.
Yo, very, very easy. I come, I see, I conquer.
Oh, those Soviets.
Call me.
Then Lou Albano comes in with the U.S. Express, Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. Albano apparently had like a can of pop or something here, or a beer. Who knows? And Rotundo's, what charisma from these guys here. Rotundo says, all the talk is done. And then Windham somehow was even less talkative than Rotundo.
Windham says, Gene, we're going to go to the ring now. That was the extent of his promo.
Thank God for Lou Albano with these two. So we get Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo taking on the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff for the tag titles. I had more music dubbed over Windham and Rotundo, who, during the broadcast, they came out to Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen.
Huh.
And in another trivia note, Hulk Hogan's Real American theme was actually, it was initially written for the U.S. Express.
Oh.
And the word is that Hogan heard it, loved it, and was like, no, I'm taking that.
Oh, okay. So, wow.
It did Hogan much better than it would have Windham and Rotundo.
Oh, yeah. It would have been completely forgotten.
Imagine Windham and Rotundo coming out to that.
I could imagine it. Yeah. It would totally fit them.
Anyway, Volkoff sings the Soviet national anthem. I love this. They got such great heat here. Garbage was thrown into the ring. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys were just hated.
Number one! Iran! Number one! USA!
is awesome.
I mean, it's such a cliche now, but it's just so awesome watching these gimmicks when they actually
were at their
worked
peak
and were at their
peak.
Look
at 1985 here. I mean, when the whole Iranian hostage situation had just happened a couple of years ago. You had the Cold War. It was much more fresh in people's minds. Yep. Whereas, you know, you even look today at all the times they tried to get Daivari over as in the post 9/11, you know, trying to get heat. And it was such cheap heat that I don't see how anyone could have had a reaction like these guys did. And it was just it worked for that time period. I just came.
Maybe, but don't you think that has anything to do with how wrestling was perceived now, back then versus now? I mean, back then, I don't know how.
I view these guys as just simply playing
characters.
A role that were probably nice guys in real life.
Whereas, you know, with Sean Daivari or Muhammad Hassan, you knew that this was just a weak attempt from writers trying to make me angry.
Then the match starts. We see the clock in the background at Madison Square Garden. It was 2:02 p.m. when this match began, Way.
2:02 p.m.? This was an afternoon show.
I guess so, yes.
Huh.
Ventura states that you see dead Super Bowls and dead World Series, but not a dead WrestleMania. We see a hip toss and a drop kick by Rotundo to Sheik for a big pop. Wyndham teases it before he hits a leg drop onto the abdomen of the Iron Sheik. Sheik then misses Wyndham and knocks Volkov off the apron with a knee, and this was the first replay we got during the body of a match. The heels worked over Rotundo with frequent tags and pinfall attempts. Then we saw an abdominal stretch by Sheik to Rotundo. Rotundo then flipped Sheik over, and it built to Wyndham with a hot tag, who got in with Volkov, hit a bulldog, but Sheik broke up the count. The referee is distracted with Mike Rotundo as Sheik hits Wyndham with Blassie's cane, and Volkov pins Wyndham for the win, and they win the tag titles. Crowd was pissed after this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this match was fine for what it was, but the crowd really made a difference here. I thought they were into everybody.
Absolutely.
Here.
I mean, a very average match, but it again, I felt like a match like this totally lives up to today's standards, at least for a TV wrestling match. You know what I mean? It was just very quick, simple. Sheik uses a cane. It was really nice to see the Iron Sheik in shape and actually able to do stuff in the ring.
You just have to go back 27 years.
Sure.
Hayes throws to another interview to tee up the $15,000 body slam challenge. Oh, first of all, we got Oakland backstage with Blassie, Sheik, and Volkov. Blassie says there was no controversy, says he didn't even have a cane. And Sheik says they proved it to the Iranians, the Arabs, and the Soviets, as there is blood on the hand of Sheik that the announcers bring up.
That's fantastic. I love these guys.
So then we get Okerlund with Bobby Heenan and Big John Studd. They're carrying a WWF duffel bag with $15,000 inside. Says this will be Andre's final match as Okerlund tries to reach into the bag and steal money. And we get no interview from Andre here. And the next match, Big John Studd with Bobby Heenan taking on Andre the Giant in a $15,000 slam match with Andre's career on the line if he lost this match. Andre comes out to a very good reaction. Studd attacks right away, but Andre comes back with chops as Studd goes to the floor. They talk about Andre's size 24 feet, and then the cameraman, probably number 5, zoomed in on the feet of Andre as Gorilla and Ventura discussed this stat. Andre has a choke, but the referee is not counting. Studd is the first to go for a slam, but ends up taking a knee by Andre. Then Andre applies a bear hug as fans are chanting slam. Very, very slow match.
Oh, yeah.
Andre catches a leg and kicks Studd in the upper leg, continues with low leg kicks like he was Uriah Faber. Jose Aldo hitting Uriah Faber, and gets the body slam for the win after the low leg kicks wore that down Studd. So Andre gets the win, takes the money, starts throwing it to the crowd, and then Bobby Heenan runs in from behind, takes the bag, and bolts. Not a good match at all.
I thought this was perhaps the weakest match on the show. This and maybe the women's. But, hey, it's what you'd expect from Andre at this point.
Andre was just an attraction people wanted to see.
Yeah.
And this was one of the heavily pushed matches for WrestleMania.
At the end of the match, Andre just takes the money and tosses it around, and Heenan quickly steals it back.
So they didn't really deliver on. Well, yeah. I guess Andre technically won the $15,000. He just
Heenan stole it.
Okerlund's with Andre backstage. Andre says he doesn't know where the money went.
and he wanted to prove he could slam him, and he is not retiring. Oakland is with Cyndi Lauper and Wendi Richter.
All right, moments away. The ladies' title up for grabs. Cyndi Lauper, Wendi Richter, a big one for you.
That's right, Mean Gene. Shmuller, Lanny Carr, you better watch out because these are powerful words because this is a powerful woman, and I'm a powerful manager now because I was taught by Captain Lou Albano just how to manage.
Wendi Richter, your thoughts?
I didn't lose that belt to one person. I lost it because Moolah interfered in my match, and I'm dead set on getting it back where it belongs.
All right, ladies, please, please, ladies, I thank you very much. Cyndi Lauper and Wendi Richter.
Richter had a very southern accent. It was very hard to understand her at times.
But, like, Cyndi Lauper here, way better than Snooki. Way better.
Yes, I agree. There's a transition, and there was literally just a WrestleMania graphic that flipped as then Fabulous Moolah comes in with Leilani Kai there with Okerlund, and Leilani Kai says that she's going to have her arm raised in Victor.
In Victor?
She said in Victor.
Okay.
That might be painful for Victor.
Okay.
So then we get the women's match, Leilani Kai with Fabulous Moolah versus Wendi Richter with Cyndi Lauper for the WWF Ladies' Championship. They did not replace Girls Just Want to Have Fun on this, which is what the Babyfaces came out to. Big pop just for the song alone.
Oh, I love that song.
So that's a great song. Cyndi Lauper was a huge, huge star here. Moolah was out, and she had these glasses on with dollar signs on them. And the match starts. Richter hits a forearm and then an overly dramatic bump by Kai as she takes the forearm. See a hammerlock by Richter. Leilani Kai taps, but the match continues. So it should have been over in like a minute. Kai then comes back with a snapmare for a two count. Kai's working on the left arm of Richter. Then Richter gets Kai in her closed guard, which is called the leg scissors by Ventura. But Kai pulls up, she postures up, and it's broken. This was the early days of MMA right here in 1985, way. Moolah ends up grabbing Richter by the hair, and it leads to Lauper getting involved, very similar to Bruno Sammartino's involvement earlier in his match. Kai then hits a running boot to the chest. There's a comeback by Richter, who puts Kai into the Samoan drop position and drops her for a two count. Then a body slam by Kai. She goes to the top rope, hits a cross body to a standing Richter, who reverses it. This very bad. And it's reversed. Richter gets the pin. I don't see how this stopped Kai. It was like this awkward momentum that Richter got. Anyway, the babyfaces win. Richter gets the title. They celebrate. They dance. And this was when you started to notice how many times Gorilla Monsoon made the comments, "It's a happening," and "History made here." This was his go-to phrases right. of the night.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy this match either, but... you know, a match like this, it was more about the promotion than the match itself.
The crowd was into it. They loved the entrance and the pop for the finish.
And I think maybe perhaps on a large scale, this was this really was an original usage of having a celebrity manager endorse a wrestler.
This was the second most promoted match, and you can definitely make the distinction that this match did draw a significant portion of this this show.
Now, my question is, are you a Cyndi Lauper fan?
Yeah, I like Cyndi Lauper.
You're a Cyndi Lauper fan? Okay. Did being a Cyndi Lauper fan make you interested in the outcome of this match? Or was it just about seeing Cyndi Lauper ringside and you didn't care about the outcome? Because, you know, this is it's a concept that's still used in wrestling today. Like, I mean, take for instance the Bobby Lashley and Umaga Donald Trump match.
It's tremendously
where you had,
successful.
Yeah, all your heat was on the people outside of the ring. Did it make you interested? Like, it's just interesting to see how they put the interest into the competitors in the match itself.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say when we like weren't fans at this time and knowing what the interest level was just in Cyndi Lauper alone. But from those that were around at this time, I mean, Cyndi Lauper did a ton of promotion for this show, was really into it. And she was like a top level celebrity coming into wrestling, which was very unique, for WWF fans at that time, period. Yeah.
Yes, I know. But, my question was just how do you transfer that celebrity interest into interest in the match without putting the celebrity into the match itself?
I think, you know, just the way that they built it up with Lauper gaining revenge, because the Ward have settled a score. They did like a huge like brawl with all these with Lauper involved, with Piper in there as well. That I think just the idea of Cyndi Lauper coming and maybe she would physically get involved with Moolah or get involved somehow. They were really trying to push Wendi Richter as well at a pretty high level at this point in time.
Yeah,
she was like right underneath Hulk Hogan at this point as someone they were really trying to get over to the top level. So I think just having Cyndi Lauper endorsing Wendi Richter, it was a positive for the company. And I think just seeing Cyndi Lauper in this environment coming off that war to settle the score was enough for people. So then we move on, everybody, and afterwards there was a post-match promo. Okerlund was with the women. Richter cuts a promo. I have no idea what she said during this promo. And then they referred to Leilani as Leilani Fly and Leilani Cow, as Richter shows off a title that looks to be made out of cardboard. She is now the ladies' champion, way. Then Howard Finkel announces it's time for the main event. The crowd goes nuts for this announcement. They introduce the celebrities Billy Martin as the guest ring announcer. Then they bring out the guest timekeeper Liberace, who comes out with the Rockettes. And then Muhammad Ali, who gets a huge chant of Ali. And that leads to our main event way. Hulk Hogan and Mr. T, accompanied by Jimmy Snuka, taking on Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff with Bob Orton Jr. And the heels came out to a giant throng of bagpipers. This was a very cool entrance.
It was. And it's... I found it interesting that they would even give the heels any type of entrance.
Like, this had the feel of, like, a real big deal, this main event. Mm-hmm. Like, these were...
Well, they piled all their celebrities here into one match.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than spreading them out on the card, they put everybody into this main event.
I didn't have any problem with that at all. I thought it just made this main event come across as just this huge, huge deal. Mm-hmm. And it made the people involved in the match seem larger than life.
And, you know, somebody like Muhammad Ali being involved in this match, I don't even hear about that, though. You don't even think about it today. You know what I mean? The mm-hmm. only people you really remember from this match are Mr. T and maybe Liberace because of the guests, the dancing with the Rockettes that you still see today.
Mm-hmm.
But, like... Someone like Ali, or I don't even think is talked about that much.
The way they set this up was that Muhammad Ali would be the outside enforcer referee, and Pat Patterson would be the official inside the ring. Hogan starts the match with Orndorff, and Monsoon calls this the happening of the century. Ventura calls it the biggest match in the history of wrestling. Piper decides to start instead and tags out. Piper then decides to start, and he tags Orndorff to get in. And at this point, Hogan then tags Mr. T, who wants in. So we start off with Piper and Mr. T right away. And they exchange slaps until Piper kicks him in the gut and does a takedown. Piper then drops Mr. T off his shoulders, and it leads to a brawl spot with everybody involved, including Snuka and Orton from outside. And it was all designed for Muhammad Ali to restore order and get his spot in as he gets into the ring. And this was designed just for a big pop for Muhammad Ali. Billy Martin is smiling as he watches on here. The heels tease leaving, but Ali shouts, "Get back!" And Hogan stops Pat Patterson from counting. Hogan then attacks Piper, delivers an atomic drop. Mr. T comes in and slams Piper and then delivers a hip toss to Orndorff. They kept Mr. T's spots pretty basic, but mm-hmm. The heels were just required to really bump for him and yep. really make Mr. T look smooth in the ring.
And he actually looked like a very capable guy. Like, I compare him to somebody like Lawrence Taylor, and Mr. T looked a lot better than someone like Lawrence Taylor. Granted, like, he was protected very well here, but Mr. T is actually a very athletic guy. He did some nice body slams.
We see a big boot by Hogan, which sends Piper to the floor, and then Orndorff gets the heat back, sends Hogan to the floor, and then Piper ends up hitting Hogan with a chair. The heels keep Hogan in their corner, and he's just selling. We see a double atomic drop as Ali gets in the ring to stop the double teaming. The heels continue to get the heat, tagging in and out with Hogan continuing to sell. Then Orndorff misses a flying knee off the top, and it lets Hogan make the hot tag to Mr. T. Piper applies a front face lock onto Mr. T and wears him down. T then powers out and tags in Hogan. Then we saw Orton get onto the apron, and Jimmy Snuka jumps into the ring to stop him. Everyone is involved here in the ring. Orndorff applies a full Nelson to Hogan as everyone is distracted. Orton then gets to the top rope, takes out Paul Orndorff with his cast as Hogan powers out of the full Nelson, and then gets the pin, and the babyfaces get the win here. They pose and celebrate after the match with Snuka, Martin, Ali, and Liberace all in the ring after the match. You know, not a spectacular main event by any stretch, but the crowd was really into the finish, getting to see the babyfaces get the big win, and Piper had no interest in doing the job in this match, and therefore you had Orndorff there to take the fall for Piper, and I think this came off about as much as well as you could expect, considering the limitations of someone like Mr. T and working all these different components into this match with the celebrities and getting Mr. T in there as well.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I mean, not a very good technical match. And that's not what you would expect anyway, though.
No. I mean, no, this is a perfect example, this entire show, of this. They were not selling, you know, top-level professional wrestling matches.
No,
nor was that the draw.
Exactly.
To this. It was seeing stars. And this, to me, is a perfect lesson for people that, I mean, this the wrestling on this show was not great in any sense, but it was like these huge stars that people wanted to see. And that, yeah, at the end of the day, is the goal you're trying to accomplish.
Yes, and it still is to this day. I mean, aside from, you know, the people who listen to this podcast and you and I, hardcore wrestling fans, I really don't think the general public cares that much about work rate.
No.
Sure, I mean, like, if it's a really bad match, then it'll stink up anything. But I think promotion is an understated importance that people like us, maybe, and fans like us often neglect.
The fact is, I always just narrow it down to, like, the reaction that two performers can elicit out of a crowd. I mean, this crowd was going crazy,
yeah,
for this main event, and it had nothing to do with what was happening in the ring. It was just the fact that these people viewed everyone in this match as stars, and they were very much invested in who was going to win this huge tag match that, mm-hmm, was promoted for weeks and weeks and was promoted as being the biggest wrestling match in history. Whether, mm-hmm, it was or not is irrelevant. If you can convince the viewer of that fact, and you've won them over.
Yeah. And you can have the best match in the world, but if you don't care about the outcome, then who cares? This goes for MMA, this goes for anything.
It goes for boxing, it goes for anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the idea of selling stars, and, mm-hmm, that's to me the ultimate goal of any kind of combat sport or any form of entertainment. That's, yeah, what you're selling. So that was WrestleMania. After the match, they did a quick interview with Hogan, Muhammad Ali, and Jimmy Snuka.
It was rough. Like I said, I trained hard. We've been training a long time. The World Wrestling Federation, Hulk Hogan. And I'm glad to be a part. It's rough out there. Like I said, I didn't take the guys lightly. I know they're well conditioned. It's rough out there. It's not for no wimps wrestling. You got to be ready.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. T. In the combat zone, Hulk.
Well, you know what turned me on, Mean Gene? The whole time I've been training with a dude, I knew what was inside right here, brother. Everybody, Madison Square Garden, all the way around the world. Now you know what it's all about, brother. I don't pick no sides. Is for partners. And you know something? My main man, Jimmy Snuka, and Mr. T, this guy right here, he was so fired up, I thought he was going to beat everybody up by himself. But you know something? WrestleMania, Hulk Hogan, Mr. T, Superfly, Jimmy Snuka, we reign supreme. Can you dig that?
I can dig it at this point in time, proving conclusively. Yes, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, it had to be a privilege for you to be in the corner of these two men.
Brother, it was a great pleasure for me, around the world, nationwide, to have Mr. T and, of course, the Big Brother Hawk. Like they said, they didn't take the brothers lightly. But he sure came out victory, and that's the most important thing. Mr. T, Big Brother.
Thank you, brother.
Love you, brother.
You know, the Superfly and Mr. T, we're going to be around for a long, long time.
All right,
you better believe it.
Mr. T cut basically a post-UFC fight promo. Hogan then cut a very post-WrestleMania circa 1985 promo. And Jimmy Snuka cut a post drug-induced promo. I don't know what he said here. This was Jimmy Snuka.
This was Snuka. He wasn't as bad as
some
maybe
other
we've
promos,
seen.
But Jimmy Snuka, I don't even know if he knew where he was.
But this was an example of a good classic Hogan promo, and I thought a nice way to end the show.
This show did a lot for Hulk Hogan. The whole promotion for this event and coming out of it. I mean, very similar to what we've looked at with last week with Tyson and Austin, what they're trying to do now with Rock and Cena, of trying to transfer that star power. And coming out of this, Mr. T might have brought a lot of interest, but you put a lot of interest on Hulk Hogan coming out of this. I mean, he was already a pretty big star going into this, but this was really a solidification of Hogan as this top national star, not just some territorial star in the Northeast.
And that's always been the concept of WrestleMania from the beginning, was to try to catapult your stars into the mainstream world, to make your stars actual celebrities rather than just a pro wrestling celebrity.
So WrestleMania 1, what do you give this out of a 10, Way? Because it's
this is
weird. You're not grading. I'm not grading this on a just simply a bell-to-bell wrestling show. The significance of this show is huge.
Yeah.
I mean,
The way I grade these shows, I grade all of them based on my own personal viewing of it. As a 27-year-old who's not very familiar with this era of pro wrestling, it's tough to give a grade without having been there for all the promotion and all the hype. But as a standalone viewing, I really liked watching it for its historical significance, and also to see what today's product, how we got to the evolution of today's product from this show. So I give it a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, I was right around the same area of giving it a 6 out of 10. I thought this show, just watching it, it was really fun to watch this show. And again, the actual wrestling is nothing to write home about, but that's not really what this show was about.
And that's not what we watch wrestling for, let's be honest. We don't just watch for work rate.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's just such a narrow way to really watch and really assess something. I mean, this was a crowd that was really into a lot of stuff on this show. I mean, whether it be Bruno or Cyndi Lauper or the main event, even Andre's Slam. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that drew people in, and it made it an enjoyable show to watch. So. Mm-hmm.
The gimmicks were a lot less colorful at this time. I mean, I don't know specifically when the WWE sort of took that more cartoonish direction, but here, all the characters were very much, like, realistic and not gimmicky at all.
Well, it's still very much tied to the WWF that preceded Vince McMahon Jr. and kind of taking those characters and ushering them into this new era that really we were only seeing the beginning footprints of that would evolve over the next couple of years as the WWF continued to expand on a national level. Like you still have to remember here in 1985, all the offices that were still in operation that were still thriving, whether it be Texas or Memphis, tons of promotions. Yeah. It's not like WWF was all of a sudden this one giant promotion that was the one dominant force. I mean, they were still very much growing at this point and expanding. This was really the roots of it all.
Mm-hmm.
So a very, very unique time period to look back at in WrestleMania history.
I liked seeing how basic everything was, and
refreshing at times. Yeah,
exactly. I think I would enjoy pro wrestling today a lot more if it went back to a lot of its roots and simple booking and simple characters like there were on this show.
Mm-hmm. So now, everyone, we're going to go over to our chat with Jimmy Hart discussing his involvement in WrestleMania 1.
Live.
Now, Jimmy, on this show, we like to review an old wrestling pay-per-view every single week. And this past week, we looked at the very first WrestleMania. And so, if you don't mind, we just want to ask you some questions about that. Yeah, and if you can just take us through your memory of what the wrestling landscape was like at the time, and also what were the circumstances that led you into the Fed at that moment?
Well, what happened, I was in Memphis, Tennessee, of course. I'd been there almost 6 years, and a friend of mine named Hillbilly Jim called me, and he goes, Jimmy, he goes, listen, WWF back then has been trying to reach you. And I said, you know, I got a call from a 203 area code number, and the guy said he was Vince McMahon, but I never called the number back, and I didn't get the message myself because I was on the road with Handsome Jimmy and Coco Beware and Plowboy Frazier back then, who was really Uncle Elmer for WWE. And, you know, we'd use the payphone, no cells back then, so I'd use the old payphone before we went to the shows, and I'd call home, and they'd say, yeah, Vince McMahon called here for you, and I thought it was a joke. I laughed and went, oh, please, I thought it was Austin Idol playing a trick on me. So I didn't call the number back. A week after that, had another phone call from New York from a George Scott, who was his booker back then. Still didn't call the number back. So that's when Hillbilly finally called me. I was back home, and he said, look, Howard Finkel's been watching your Memphis tapes, and they love you. There's a show coming up in 2 months called WrestleMania, and they want to see if you'd be interested in joining the company. Of course I would. So I finally, Hillbilly made the hookup with me. Vince called me. I said, I want in. What I need to do? He said, I need you on a plane tomorrow. Took a flight to, they flew me in to New York, Stamford, Connecticut, the next day. Sit down with him. He let me come back. He was so gracious to let me run the wrestling show that week because Jerry Lawler was in Japan on a tour, and Jerry Jarrett, our promoter back then and owner of the company, was on a hunting trip, so it was my job to run the TV. So he let me come back and run the TV. I turned my notice in, went to New York. But the experience was so unbelievable. I got to go to the ring with Greg the Hammer Valentine. I managed Greg at the time. And then also, I was managing King Kong Bundy. I had managed Bundy in Memphis, so I'd managed him up there before I traded him off to Bobby Heenan. And he fought S.D. Jones and won that match. And I don't know if it was 9, 10, or 16 seconds. Everybody's got a different memory on that. But it was such a thrill to me, to meeting Muhammad Ali and Cyndi Lauper and being part of the Dick Clark experience, because I had been with Dick Clark years and years and years before with the Gentrys on the tours with Dick Clark when we were touring with Sonny and Cher and everybody. So, you know, coming from Memphis, driving in cars everywhere and not flying, it was just a great experience.
And how was the initial concept of WrestleMania first presented to you? Did you have any idea that it would be as big of an event as it was?
Buddy, I didn't know anything about it, because you forget the only access we had to New York wrestling or any of the other territories was by Bill After and all the magazines that Stu Saxon them put out. You know, that's why I knew about Bobby Heenan. I'd read all this about Bobby Heenan and all the different wrestlers New York would have at the time, from our wrestling magazines. And I think the Superstation might be coming in, if you could afford cable back then, and see some of the stuff back that was taking place in Atlanta, Georgia. But other than that, you know, all the territories were separated back then. You know, Florida had its, Texas had theirs, and I was experiencing a little bit of some of the guys coming in, because on the feud I had with Jerry Lawler, I was able to bring, you know, Terry Funk would come in from Texas and from Florida, Dusty Rhodes, or Ric Flair from Charlotte, and I'd manage all these guys going up against Lawler week after week. And that was one of my first experiences with Hulkster. I'd met Hulk years and years before in Memphis, before I got into wrestling, when I was doing the Gentry stuff, the band. But he was Terry Boulder back then. Him and Brutus were Terry Boulder, a brother tag team, and I knew he was going to be a major star back then when I saw him. But then the next time I met Hulk and brought him in was after I got into wrestling, and he came in one night from Minnesota to go up against the King for me.
Was going to the World Wrestling Federation and that entire Northeast territory something that you had ever aspired to, Jimmy? Because really you had like that kind of holy trinity of managers there at the time during the 70s. It was always a staple, whether it be Fred Blassie or the Grand Wizard, Captain Lou Albano, that it was really tough for managers to get into that territory. And it became, you know, a manager that can make it there in the Northeast that really kind of set your stamp there in the wrestling industry at the time.
Well, it turned out, Ray Lawler always used to say, sometimes, Jimmy Hart, it's better to be lucky than to be good. And I said, I hope I'm lucky and good. But went to New York, and of course, a lot of the managers, except from the Wizard, were professional wrestlers, ex-professional wrestlers. You know, Bobby Heenan used to wrestle, and then he was a manager. Lou Albano used to wrestle, then he was a manager. But then we had Fred Blassie used to wrestle, then he was a manager. And gosh, the list just went on and on. And Mr. Fuji, too, who was managing up there, and he was an ex-wrestler. So me coming in, I don't mind telling you, I was a little scared to death on the thing, but it turned out great. The thing for me, too, a lot of the managers back then would go out maybe one time a night, take their robes or jackets from the managers, do an interview, and then leave. When I went up there, Vince McMahon, I was lucky enough to let me go to the ring 3 or 4 times a night. Everybody thought, man, if you go 3 or 4 times a night and get knocked around every match, you won't be here 6 months. But I stayed almost 10 years. I think that's what really helped me, especially when you see all the old videos and stuff out now, because I'm on 3 or 4 of the matches when they release a lot of these tapes that are out there now. So, and being colorful, you know, when I got to manage Honky Tonk Man and the Hart Foundation and all these people, you know, I had Neidhart first, and then later on they brought Brett in, and we became the Hart Foundation. But I've been blessed. I really have.
And it's also interesting, Jimmy, when you look back at just the influence that the Memphis territory had. I mean, you guys were really ahead of your time. I mean, when you were using Andy Kaufman and the celebrity involvement, it was very minuscule at that time period and proved to be a tremendously successful angle. You look at other stuff like the Tupelo concession stand brawl match and how that ended up just growing into what we saw in the late 90s with different companies. And it seemed that Memphis always seemed to be somewhat ahead of the curve of what was going to be very popular and connect with the audience and really knowing its audience.
Well, you know, you just mentioned something, too. We didn't use the word hardcore back then. We didn't know what it really meant.
Uh-huh.
When ECW came along and started doing hardcore, all the stuff these guys did, they were tremendous. I realized with the barbed wire matches they were having and the fire matches and the scaffold matches and the pole matches and everything they were doing, me and Lawler were talking, but I said, oh my God, we started in Memphis doing that years and years ago, and I'm sure probably some of the other territories did too. I remember one of the matches we had in Memphis was the dog food match, me and Bobby Eaton against Coco and Lawler. I thought I was going to trick everybody, and I said, Bobby, look, don't tell anybody. So I got a can of chili, I got a can of Alpo dog food, I switched the labels on it, but when we lost the match and we had to open the dog food, which was really chili, we still gagged and threw up in the ring because cold chili is still bad to eat. So, it was so much fun back then, but we really didn't know what we were really having. The Andy Kaufman thing. Andy stayed at my house. I was with Andy off and on for almost a year and a half, managing him back and forth too. So, a lot of that video is going to be coming out over the next year too. We found a lot more stuff on Andy and them, and so it's going to be great.
Jimmy, you know, being very familiar with the idea of incorporating celebrities into professional wrestling, like you just mentioned with Andy Kaufman, as wrestling fans, we've seen a lot of good instances of celebrity involvement and a lot of bad instances of celebrity involvement in pro wrestling. In your opinion, what are the guidelines for successful co-promotion with celebrities in wrestling?
Well, first of all, I think Vince, what a stroke of genius getting Snooki in from the Jersey Shore. I was just looking at the Jersey Shore rating. I think they did 7.2 million households saw them last week.
Mm-hmm.
On Monday Night Raw, 5.8 million households saw the second hour, 5.7 million the first hour, I believe. That is just unbelievable for this to happen. So I think WWE's always on the threshold of really staying in current on what's really happening. So it's just a lot of celebrities. You know, I've been around a lot of them that we've used in Memphis, of course, and in WCW, and, of course, the New York thing, too. But I think when WWE does them, I think they always use them to the best of their ability. They know their strong points, their weaknesses, and bring them in just at the right time for the fans that they can enjoy the people that they go out watching, too. But it's been a blast for me, and just still be part of WrestleMania and be part of the WWE Nation. It's just tremendous.
Going back to that first WrestleMania, Jimmy, I mean, you look up and down the card, and for my money, you took the biggest bump on this show during the Greg Valentine Junkyard Dog match, where Valentine was running in to hit Junkyard Dog. He sidestepped, hit you, and you ended up going down and falling back first. And this was back before they had the blue pads up, so you were falling right on the cement. I don't know if you recall this bump, but it looked horrific watching it on tape, the pain you must have been in.
Well, you know, thank you for saying that. But you know what? My whole thing was this, and I learned this from Dick Clark. Dick Clark, when I first got into music, you know, I remember what he said when I went into wrestling. He said, when you're on the stage, you got to give them everything you've got. I mean, go all out. And remember, if you dress like the audience, one day you're going to wind up sitting in the audience. That's why I was always trying to dress as colorful as I could, to be a little bit different, to give the fans that much more. And on stage, as far as singing, did the best we could. But as far as taking bumps in the ring, I just wanted to give that special thing. You know, people always say, what's the greatest moment? Was it WrestleMania 3, where you were out three different times with the Hart Foundation, the Honky Tonk Man, and Adrian Adonis in their matches? That was great. Was getting the WWE Hall of Fame, that was unbelievable, getting the ring. But WrestleMania 1 still stands out, because if WrestleMania 1 had not been successful, you know, I wouldn't be sitting here on the phone talking to you now, you know. So, like I said, lucky, grateful, everything that goes along with it. I'm so blessed to be around this business this many years. It's just been awesome.
What was the feeling like backstage immediately after the event was over? Because there was a lot riding on, like you said, the success or failure of this event.
A lot of stress going into it, because I know that the McMahons had put up everything they had to try to make this work, the house, just everything. And I know a lot of people thought, hey, let's don't try to branch out all over the world. Let's just stay in our own backyard. We've got Pennsylvania. We've got New York. We're doing our thing. This is great. We've got Massachusetts. This is awesome. And a lot of the old-timers tried to talk him out of it. But you know, Vince, he was great. And it just turned out unbelievable. I think after it was over, it was a sigh of relief. Nobody really knew, because back then, I think our pay-per-views were in different movie theaters. You know, it wasn't known like a pay-per-view for TV. So that had the first time going in, would fans really go, without seeing a live match, or really go to a movie theater and see this. But, you know, it's just been phenomenal, just everything that's happened with this. I mean, who would ever believe that after all these years, people would still come in from Japan and, you know, God bless those people over there, what's happening over there right now, in Korea and Germany and Australia and just everywhere. But, you know, wrestling, I believe, is just stronger than ever now.
Mm. That event also featured the introduction of the rock and wrestling connection. And being somebody who has achieved success in both the rock and roll field and professional wrestling, what do you think are the qualities about the two that that make the crossover so natural?
Well, you know, I think music goes along with anything. You know, if you go to a baseball game, football game, or anything, music's involved. But I think the music with the wrestling, great entrance themes. I was over in Afghanistan year before last, and I remember one of the guys over there goes, Jimmy, you know, I love wrestling. He said, I love to watch the pyro, and I love the theme music going out. I mean, this kid was really into this, one of these, I think it was in the 101st Airborne, you know, and so, which my son Jimmy Jr. was in the 82nd Airborne. So, you know, I've tried to go the last 3 years with you know, overseas on the USO stuff, but I remember him saying he loves the theme music, and he loved it. But I just think nowadays when you hear a theme song before the wrestler even comes out, the theme songs are so established. And gosh, we did in WCW, we did the National Hall theme, the Wolfpack song. We did the Road Warriors theme in WWE. We had Snookers. We had Repo Man. We had, of course, all of Honky Tonk Man's greatest hits, A Hunk of Honky Glove and Honky Dog Baby. And so the Rougeau Brothers, one of my favorites, All American Boys.
Oh, yeah.
And I always still go, people say, what's your words to the moment? I said, we don't like heavy metal. We don't like rock and roll. All we like to listen to is Barry Manilow, and Jock and Raymond were great. The Heart Foundation theme we wrote, Ted DiBiase's Million Dollar Man. I mean, some Brutus Beefcake, so many of them, Hulk's American Made. But like I said, a good theme song, a good entrance, really, I think, excites the people and just gets them ready for that match.
And that was Jimmy Hart, everybody, the mouth of the South, who will be involved in all of the WrestleMania 27 weekend activities, and always a great time chatting with Jimmy Hart. So at this point, let's get into feedback, because lots of people want to chime in with their thoughts as we run down. Here we go. Stephen Gillis. Stephen Gillis, great review of WrestleMania 14, guys. Just wanted to mention that your outro song was executive produced by Simon Cowell of American Idol fame. The Superstars album actually launched his music career comeback, and then he went on to produce such amazing novelty acts as Mighty Morphin, Power Rangers, and Teletubbies.
That's quite the resume.
There you
go. Wow.
From American Idol. Look at the early days of this guy. As the story goes, Simon came up with the idea of doing a wrestling album with the WWF while watching wrestling at his mother's house and connecting its popularity. He moved back home after having financial trouble and his career floundering. The funny part is, we all think that he is this amazing music producer, but wrestling is what really launched him and was his first top-selling album. Very interesting there.
So this multi-millionaire, is that what he is now? This multi-millionaire dick that's on national TV, this TV and music industry mogul,
was watching wrestling in his mom's basement and was inspired.
Yes, and also worked on Power Rangers and Teletubbies. Cool. Ahmad Butt, approximately 2 weeks ago, I suffered from testicular torsion. Torsion is the twisting of one of the testicles, which causes oxygen and or blood to be cut off to the ball.
What is going on here?
Apparently, it just happens. The doctor said if I didn't have the surgery within the next hour, I would lose the testicle. Color me worried. Well, I did go under, and I'm happy to say my boy is saved. Review Away comes into play because I had to veg out on antibiotics and Percocet while exerting minimal activity. So while I laid in bed for 12 to 6 hours for a course of several days... 12 to 16 hours over the course of several days, I put on episodes of Review Away as well as the hilarious Mad Men Recap podcast. My suggestion for a law add-on. You guys already spoke about reviewing the new Tough Enough, so that's a possibility. Vintage Collection is another choice. Reading the best, funniest, or stupidest tweets from pro wrestling personalities is another.
Well, first of all, Ahmad, I'm glad your testicles are okay, and hopefully you can continue photoshopping, because...
You can't do that without...
It's a big asset for us to have you doing. that's great. I'm glad that your Percocets and Review Away got you through your ball issues.
Yes.
Ali Muhammad. I just finished watching the new WrestleMania DVD. It was one of the best wrestling documentaries I've ever seen in a long time. This is the best DVD they have produced since Heartbreak and Triumph. It features many scenes from never-before-seen angles and some really cool new insight. For example, I didn't know that Howard Finkel came up with the name WrestleMania, and I also didn't know that Austin had OMR written on his jacket in his last match, and it meant one more round. I highly recommend this DVD to all wrestling fans. This is definitely a DVD you can show a non-wrestling fan and make a fan out of him. I gave it 5 out of 5 stars. A lot of people have been positive about that DVD.
Dashing Evan Harden. Great review of WrestleMania 14, guys. One thing I want to point out is that I'm surprised you guys didn't mention the fact that during the post-show press conference, Shawn Michaels violently walked out and slammed the door behind him with Hunter right behind him. If it didn't show it on the video exclusive, then it will definitely show in one of Shawn Michaels' DVDs, Heartbreak and Triumph.
Yeah, I didn't see that on the...
He just stormed out.
VHS I watched.
Was he actually pissed?
This was his back was legit. Fucked. Like, he was taken to the hospital after that.
Okay.
Jay Hunter, for maximum enjoyment on minimum effort, I think you guys should do a mailbag Q&A segment for After the Law. Q's should be wrestling related. Yes, just make a thread about it each week, like you do with Review of Raw and Review an Impact. Voila, which is French for ta-da.
Okay. What about that idea?
That's a good idea. That's a good one, too. I think by the time people are listening to this, they'll hear our first incarnation of what we have planned, and it's something that can grow from there, and we'll see where things go. But I'm always up to, sometimes people have a lot of questions that don't center around a specific time period and just have random questions.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And
so...
me and Wei have some expertise.
That's right. Rohan Unrau, thoughts on WrestleMania 14. The only significant thing about this event was that I rented the VHS from a local Blockbuster. I then carefully unscrewed the tape case, slit the security sticker with a razor blade, removed the tape reels, and replaced it with blank tape, put the screws back in, and returned it to the store claiming the tape was defective. I did this about 30 times to various video stores in my area, so if there is anyone who rented wrestling videotapes in the Winnipeg area who only saw blank tape when they watched, well, sorry. I had a tape collection to add to. I think I'm the reason Blockbuster stopped renting wrestling tapes. I know, dick move. That is a real
dick. It's a total dick move. As someone that, like,
God damn.
I would remember, like, months after a pay-per-view, like, running to my video store on a weekly basis when they would finally get the tape of the event.
Oh, man.
And knowing that a guy would steal it, I would have hated this guy.
This is, like, much. Why don't... Could you not have just hooked up two VCRs together?
Very simple. And just copy it.
Fuck.
It's not the not very tough at all. How many wrestling fans did this guy probably kill?
I don't know, but I just unscrewed the tape case, take the security
sticker
off.
Hell of a fucking job.
And remove the tape reels. Oh, man.
God.
John
Funk. Hey, John and Wei. I have never been a big Undertaker fan, feeling he is highly overrated as a wrestler and a performer. I have always viewed the majority of his matches quite boring. The thing that bothers me the most is the ridiculous streak. When it was first pointed out several years ago, it was kind of cool, but quickly lost its luster when they began to shove it down our throats. He is 18-0 with only a handful of actual good WrestleMania matches. It takes away any shock or hint of surprise from the match or the show as a whole, knowing who is going to win. I disagree a lot to that. I think that's something people get into every year. It's like the guaranteed gimmick that people take seriously.
But he does bring up a good question when he says that they're very predictable now. You know, everybody knows that Undertaker is going to win this WrestleMania. How do they continue making you question that a Taker could lose this one?
I didn't foresee that being an issue the last 2 years at all with Shawn Michaels, to be honest. And I felt
because those were great matches. But did you actually think for a second Michaels was going to beat Undertaker?
I didn't see that as any kind of issue where someone would not order a pay-per-view because of it or not be into the match. I mean, if that was the case, no one would have popped for any of Shawn Michaels' false finishes on any of those matches, and there were plenty of them.
Hmm.
So I've in terms of his style, I mean, I feel The Undertaker, his real in-ring legacy is going to be over the latter part of his career. It's been the last like 5-6 years where I think he's become an even better worker. And you look at those early Mania matches, look at some of the guys he was saddled with here.
Yeah.
And there's some fantastic matches he had in the mid-90s with the likes of a Bret Hart and people that could go, or Shawn Michaels.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's tough when you're in there with a Giant Gonzalez or a King Kong Bundy putting on a classic.
Well, yeah, especially with the last 2 years with Michaels, he certainly built a very high standard for himself in terms of in-ring work rate at WrestleMania. And I think he's going to do well with Hunter this time. If he is going to continue it, I hope he keeps getting good, capable wrestlers to work with.
I don't think there's going to be too many. I think one more Mania and that's it. Like, his shoulder, it sounds like it is completely fucked.
Hmm. Chris Charlton, I've only been listening to The Law for a year or so, and I know you have a long history and of in-depth interview archives. If you want a low-effort tack on the end of each week's Law, how about a vintage Law segment? Just need to hunt down a good clip or interview from the past and add a little intro and outro to it. Kevin Nash work rate maybe, but I'd be interested to hear some of the old stuff.
All right.
That's another good idea.
Mm-hmm. Then we go on to Mo from Winnipeg. Okay, I think I'm going to have to stop listening to the review podcast.
No, Mo from Vancouver.
Oh, Mo from Vancouver. I think I'm going to have to stop listening to the review podcast in crowded public venues. I was just at Walmart this afternoon buying The Fighter on Blu-ray. While browsing through the Blu-ray collection and listening to review a Raw, I could no longer control myself when Way started laughing at Jim Ross calling spots while being put in the ankle lock. God almighty had me in tears. People standing next to me started looking at me as if I was mentally disturbed. Since becoming a fan of the podcast, there are segments I watch on Raw or Impact that I know will catch the attention of John or Way, and I was certain that JR's God almighty would be one of them. That, and you're not a kangaroo, Michael. And to make your life easier, John, you can simply refer to me as Mo from Vancouver. That is Mohammed Al-Zubaydi, who I probably butchered on a weekly basis. Mo from Vancouver.
Next we have, yes, thank you.
We should note, Jim Ross was like legitimately injured in that angle.
Yeah, he was.
So it wasn't as much selling as it was the guy's knee was being like ripped apart there by Swagger.
Which I find so surprising that...
Hot crowd, big angle, and Swagger...
Well, you get hurt and... Ow.
Well, maybe... Have you ever had like strained knee ligaments? I'd probably yell God almighty if that happened to me. I'd be pissed.
Okay. Eric Creamer. People have a problem with Snooki being at Mania for almost the same reason you are confused with why Drew Carey is in the Hall of Fame this year. Neither of them have any business being there, and their impact on the world of television is played up to an unreal and undeserving degree. TMZ exposure is a good reason to bring in celebrity guest stars, but is it really worth it in the long run? You are saying she's being hidden in a match, and others say it will be forgotten just as quickly as it happened. So really, what is the point? The argument to have them there is the exact same as the argument to not have them there in the first place.
Okay, first of all, I would never lump Snooki and Drew Carey into the same league of celebrity. I mean, it's not even comparable.
Right now. I mean, in 10 years' time, yeah, definitely. But right now, Snooki is way hotter than Drew Carey.
Exactly. Drew Carey is never going to be the level that Snooki is at her peak. Second of all, we just reviewed WrestleMania 1, which, that right there, do you think anyone cared about Mr. T's work rate going into that main event?
No.
But it brought some interest. I would agree if you had Snooki in the main event of this show. I would definitely question the logic of that. She is not in the main event. She's in a nothing six-person tag where she's doing one spot where we'll probably get out of her. And what's the upside here? You'll have TMZ covering this. You'll have Entertainment Weekly covering this. I mean, it's just more added exposure. I don't see the issue here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a show that is probably on target to do 900 to 1 million buys. And with Snooki, maybe it adds a handful thousand more buys.
Mm.
I don't know. I find it just to be a pretty simple. This is probably 9 minutes of the pay-per-view will be tied up with Snooki, everybody. 9 minutes on a 4-hour pay-per-view.
Well, Eric goes on to say, celebrities at Mania is nothing new. However, there are hits that remain legendary to this day, such as Mr. T, and there are misses, such as Rhonda Shear. Yes. Sometimes you can just see the failures coming. This is how I feel about Snooki. I'll be the first to admit that I'm wrong if this turns out to be a hugely memorable event, thanks in part to Snooki's involvement. However, I think that's a hat I won't be wearing eating anytime soon.
Well, the value of Snooki is not even with what transpires on the show. It's all in... Will this add any interest to the show? I mean, outside of the pro wrestling audience. That's what they're gaining here. They're not hiring Snooki to try and get the hardcore wrestling fan that's already pre-purchased this pay-per-view. And I just don't see...
Well,
they're trying to attract an audience that is not who we are talking to on this podcast.
Well, yeah, and that's always been the philosophy behind WrestleMania, which we've been talking about for the past hour. But I think Eric's point here is that there are good celebrity involvements and bad celebrity involvements, and Eric thinks that this will be a negative one on the level of a Rhonda Shear.
We'll see. Maybe it'll be we'll fucking see. Terrible match. But to me, it's like people are...
Well, the match has nothing to do with it. It's the amount of buzz that the celebrity creates that's the judge of how well the angle does.
Yeah, so I didn't think the angle came off terribly on Monday. That was your angle. That's the last time you'll see Snooki before Mania, I would assume.
I hope so.
So we'll find out, everybody. Billy Gunn, hey guys, I'm loving the separate podcast, but if you wish for something else at the end of the law, I like the idea of reviewing the tweets and other social media of wrestling and MMA stars for the week and awarding for the most idiotic, entertaining, disturbing quote. The wrestling and MMA world offer a plethora of great material with little to no research. I got it. Review a twit. It'll be gold.
Well, thank you for all your suggestions on your post-law event and this one, if you guys haven't already listened to the law, we are actually doing. This week.
Twitter and Facebook definitely provides a ton of material for us within the world of pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, so we will continue to investigate.
So go ahead and check out the law, download it, and let us know what you think of our first post-law segment for this week. Jermone Jackson, is it me or did it seem like Don King was cutting an Ultimate Warrior promo on Reveal Wave this past week? It seemed like he was speaking a language that couldn't be understood by human beings.
Myself included. Oh, there we go. It's Don King, nonetheless. I just ask the questions. I can't control the answers.
And what an answer.
So thanks, everybody, for your feedback. As always, you can post them on the Live Audio Wrestling Review Away Facebook group. Just post your comments up there, and we do our best every week to get to as many of them as we can for all of our shows. And, of course, encourage people to join, whether it be the Law Facebook group or the Review Away Facebook group. We always are looking for new members, Way.
Yes, we are.
We are indeed.
Yep.
So that brings us to an end, everybody. Coming up, we will be back on Tuesday afternoon with Review of Raw as WrestleMania continues to inch closer, and this is the second to final Raw before the big show. Mm-hmm. So we'll be chatting about that on Tuesday afternoon. And next week, as we look ahead, Way, what would you like to review? Because it is back to your selection.
Well, this coming review is the final week before WrestleMania itself, and I would like to do the show that I think has been requested more than any of the others, as far as I know, and that is WrestleMania 17.
A stark difference, WrestleMania 1.
So WrestleMania that's critically acclaimed and well-regarded by almost everybody. So I'd like to review it simply because 10 years. This was exactly 10 years ago, and we got the first Triple H and Hunter match.
No, that never happened.
Oh, it never happened.
Never happened.
Anyway.
He's 17-0.
Yes, and of course we got Stone Cold versus The Rock, as well as TLC 2, as well as a number of other events going into that show.
This was the peak of the WWE's late 90s boom here in April of 2001. It really was the high point of that entire period.
I have a good feeling that almost all of you have seen this show already, so I would like to hear, and we would like to hear feedback from all of you guys. Get it in before Thursday when we usually record the show.
Yes, based on, I think, nobody posted comments on WrestleMania 1, so that's one of the, I think, lesser seen WrestleMania events out there. But WrestleMania 17, that'll be coming up next week, and as we continue to count down our top five wrestling theme songs, Way, we started off with Step Up by Drowning Pool, then you went with the WrestleMania rap of whatever it's called, executive produced by Simon Cowell.
Yes.
And I will continue things on. I was very surprised when they used this song. It was extremely modern for WWE tastes. But that was in 2005, Big Time by Soundtrack of Our Lives.
Wow.
I enjoyed that song a lot.
Oh, okay. Not the Peter Gabriel.
No, the next year they used Big Time again. That was the Peter Gabriel tune. That was not a modern selection. Okay. But 05, they got the modern version.
Cool. Here it is.